And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That spirited music we were just hearing is the opening to the overture of Le Nozze di Figaro, The Marriage of Figaro, by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And that is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the musical delights that are going to be presented in this coming weekend's concert by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. A concert which is also going to include the sparkling and marvelous violin concerto of Peter Tchaikovsky and Beethoven's monumental symphony number 3, known as the Eroica, for more reasons than one. And joining us to talk about what promises to be a really exciting concert and a thrilling opening to yet another season of the Kenosha Symphonies, first of all, the president of the board of directors, Peter Rodriguez, Maestro Robert Hasty, who is the artistic director of the Kenosha Symphony, and the brilliant violinist who's going to be the guest soloist for this weekend's concert, Desiree Rustrat, who is on the music faculty at Northwestern University, where, by no coincidence, Maestro Hasty is also on the faculty. And
I was on the faculty. I'm actually now the director of orchestras at the University of Central Florida.
So he's in sunnier skies now.
Whoa!
So if you see palm trees out my window, you will understand why.
Oh my gosh! Well, congratulations on that move to warmer climates, and how exciting for you! How is that going down in Florida?
It's very overwhelming to make that shift. As you mentioned, Desiree and I were colleagues when I was at Northwestern for 22. Well, we weren't colleagues for 22 years, but I was on the faculty there. But I couldn't. I was presented with an opportunity to lead an orchestra and conducting program in the Orlando, Florida area. And I just could not turn it down. And so my wife and I have moved down to Orlando and gotten used to different climate, obviously, and just really looking forward to developing the professional life down here in the Orlando area. Very grateful for my 22 years at Northwestern, which I think prepared me to get this kind of a promotion in the music world. And I'm also very grateful to the board of directors at Kenosha, who continue to offer me the music directorship of the Kenosha Symphony, while even though I was always in a different state when I was up there being in the Chicago area, but now it's just a little bit more of a commute.
I should say. Well, it's not the first time the Kenosha Symphony has had a conductor that had to travel a bit of a distance, and it's worked well in the past, and I trust it's going to work well again. So, again, welcome to everybody, and thank you, Maestro Hasty, for updating us on your biography and telling us about this exciting change. So, Peter Rodriguez, I was going to ask you just kind of a nice general overarching question about how things are going with the Kenosha Symphony, but I suspect that that this change with Maestro Hasty probably necessitated a few conversations about how best to move ahead.
Yes, good to talk to you again, Greg. We are very grateful that Bob has graciously agreed to continue his directorship with the Kenosha Symphony. I know that means he'll be, as he said, a slight change to his commute, but yes, we're grateful that he can hop on a plane and work with us for several days, and we have that experience. It's been great. And to answer your question, yes, we're very excited about this season. It's actually, if I'm not mistaken, the 84th season of the Kenosha Symphony since the symphony started in 1940. And we're lucky that we've been able to continue this orchestra for such a great amount of time.
Very good. So during the summer, it's obviously not concert season, but I don't think it's exactly off season. I'm sure you and your board have a lot to do to properly prepare for the season. Tell us a little bit about what goes into ultimately the launch of now the 84th season.
Sure. There is a lot that goes into starting our season, and it's a lot of things that happen in the background that we probably take for granted, such as making sure that we have these beautiful programs at each concert, that we have brochures and posters, and we reach out to our donors and they help support the orchestra. We couldn't exist without their support, and we're fortunate that we're going into this season confidently that we're going to be able to do all the concerts that we have planned, including our youth concerts in May. That's one of the things I love about the Kenosha Symphony, is that we offer these concerts for school children in the Kenosha area for free, and they bring literally busloads of kids to hear these concerts. And last year, because of budget, we weren't able to do that. But this year, I'm very proud to say that we will be able to continue that. And actually, last week, we heard from an anonymous donor that they're going to be giving us a generous donation of $3,000 to support that concert as well. So very grateful for the support of the Kenosha area.
Fantastic. So tell us about the putting together of this particular concert. Maestro Hasty and Peter, is this something that gets talked about together collaboratively, or does Maestro Hasty just plan everything in the splendid isolation of an ivory tower and then it just happens?
I'll let Bob start that.
Yes, well, I'm very grateful to have some musicians on the board, because as we've mentioned in previous radio interviews with you, Greg, that Pete is not only the president, but he is one of our horn players in the orchestra. So we have some of the musicians on the board, and they are very musically minded. Like with any professional orchestra, it all comes down to budgetary issues. So let's say, for instance, the concert in May will have much greater forces of percussion and brass, so I'm able to program that. That, of course, is more expensive, which we're grateful for donors and for ticket purchasers, although ticket purchase is only a fraction of the budget. But so the board presents to me, here is what we would be able to support. And then maybe for another concert, maybe you could do one with less percussion, less forces of string instruments. And so when I was given a lot of these, then I go to work. So this is completely in coordination and the support of the board. I can't, a music director who just programs willy-nilly whatever it is that they would like to perform can really put a lot of stress and pressure on a board. This way we work together. They provide me the parameters, and then I go, oh great, look at this, I can, with only three horn players instead of four, although we are going to use a fourth horn player for Eroica Symphony, we can do this within the parameters of the board. And with the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, also without a lot of percussion or low brass, it makes it within budgetary constraints. We're able to produce one of the most important symphonies in the history of music that we'll be doing next week. This week in October.
Wonderful. Peter, what do you want to add to that?
No, exactly what Bob said. It is tricky to navigate what we're able to do financially along with what we'd like to do musically. And it's always a challenge. But that being said, not only am I super excited about this next concert with Desiree joining us for the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, but also future concerts, you know, the Christmas concert, or the holiday concert, I should say, around Christmas time is extremely important to us because it's supported by Snap-on Incorporated, and they basically make that concert happen. Mm-hmm. And it's typically our most attended concert with well over 400 people there. And then the last concert of the season will be on May 4th. And so in keeping with that theme, we decided, Bob and I decided to take advantage of the date, and we're going to be doing several selections from Star Wars, which of course has been a cultural phenomenon for at least the past 50 years or so. So very excited about that as well.
May I also add that one of the other things I'm grateful for the board is that they will give me a budget for a soloist. So when we came up to deciding about the soloist, Desiree and I, obviously working together at Northwestern at the time, we came up with this plan of doing Tchaikovsky, and it didn't even enter my mind. And I said, of course, let's do it. And she goes, is there a date that is available? And then, of course, I just said, well, how about October? And so I'm just so grateful because I've worked with Desiree before, along with her husband, David Cunliffe. We've actually performed together with the Highland Park Strings. We did The Muse and the Poet by Cezanne, if I remember correctly. And then over COVID, Desiree asked, would I be interested in doing the Astor Piazzolla Four Seasons with the Chamber Orchestra at Northwestern. And even though we were doing it remotely and online, we had this great time performing there. So I just couldn't wait to bring her up to Kenosha and for us to be able to work together and doing the Tchaikovsky.
Wonderful. For those of you just joining us, we are previewing this weekend's concert of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra, Saturday evening, 7:30. At Reuther High School in the Ralph Houghton Auditorium, a concert that will feature the Beethoven Eroica Symphony, the Overture to the Marriage of Figaro by Mozart, and the Violin Concerto of Peter Tchaikovsky with very special guest soloist Desiree Rustrat. So, Desiree, I imagine that one of the best things about being a busy musician as well as educator is all of the connections that get made and the way in which you get to make music with friends and colleagues and so on. And I assume this is just yet another in a whole plethora of marvelous opportunities that you have had over the years.
Yes. I mean, and it's especially exciting for me because, as Bob had mentioned, COVID wasn't kind to musicians, and it was really, of course, quite difficult to get performing opportunities. And this was really pretty shortly after, like, literally one of the first times you were even able to perform and get out, and we had to do it remotely. There was no audience, but to be able to have that opportunity, you know, to play with an orchestra and to be with Bob again, who is, you know, he not only is a wonderful human being and an incredible friend and so forth, but the way he motivates everyone and musicians, and I can imagine it's the same way for the orchestra. His enthusiasm and his just joy for music making, it's just a real privilege and treat to be able to be playing with him.
So Desiree,
I must admit that we've played croquet together as well. And, and my record at croquet is 1-0. I'm undefeated. I've won at croquet simply because her husband David was my coach. So
he's especially really good. He's a Brit.
Very good. So Desiree, I would love to know a little bit about where you come from originally, and at what point your love affair with the violin began, and under what circumstances.
Well, I think my love affair with the violin began, as most kids do, and that's by encouragement of parents. I had a mother who would take me to symphony concerts, and I was quite young, and she took me to the symphony, and I was able to see some soloists, and she would sneak me in, even though I think I was too young. And I loved the violin, and I started when I was 3 and a half, and I've been going for my life.
I know that you studied violin at the Curtis Institute of Music, and I know that Aaron Rosand was one of your teachers, and I know I have at least two of Aaron Rosand's recordings on the shelf here at the radio station. But you've actually had quite an array of different teachers, and I find that kind of intriguing. What does one take away from having, in a sense, more than one violin teacher? And as you are now in an educational setting, I suspect that is a value that you can draw upon, kind of a rich wealth of experiences with various teachers.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, everyone has something to offer. And I had quite dramatically different teachers, yet they all had a connection. For example, this is an interesting story. My mother took me to see Eugene Fodor with the Milwaukee Symphony when I was around 7 years old. And because of that is how I ended up studying in Colorado, because my parents actually moved from Milwaukee to Colorado so I could study with Harold Whippler, who was Eugene Fodor's teacher. And Harold Whippler actually was at Curtis with Aaron Rosand. So that was the connection there, is they were classmates back a long ways ago. And so I ended up studying with a classmate of his at Curtis, dramatically different teaching styles and human beings, but both brought so much to my life and to my violin playing, and I'm so grateful. And I also had the opportunity to study with Joseph Gingles at Indiana, who was probably one of the sweetest, kindest souls. And that was something special because, I mean, literally the violin was in his hand 24 hours a day. And even while he taught, and I was with him when he was well into his 80s, and he just wouldn't let that violin go. And it was the love of his life. And he taught that way. I mean, every note he would just embrace, and he was so grateful that he, you know, it was his soul, basically, the violin. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I noticed in terms of your career, and for that matter, what you do at Northwestern, is that chamber music seems to be exceptionally important to you. I mean, I think for most violinists, that plays some sort of part in what they do, but it plays a really big part in your life and career, particularly, I mean, the work that you do at Northwestern as coordinator of their strings chamber program, chamber music program, but then also as part of the Grammy-nominated Lincoln Trio. At what point did making chamber music become especially important to you?
Well, interestingly enough, when I was growing up, I didn't have the opportunity to do very much chamber music. And I came onto it very late in life. I'd say really it was in my mid-20s when I started playing quite a bit of chamber music. And I realized, I definitely realized what I was missing growing up. And especially now for the next generation, I think chamber music is such an important thing because it's a way of really getting classical music out there into spaces that ordinarily I think we haven't gone before, that I think is important that we do, whether it be, you know, into the communities. You can go into retirement homes, into hospitals. You can now go into restaurants. I know Cleveland has quite a successful Bach in the Bar series that was actually started by some students at Curtis, and also down in Texas, I had a student of mine start a chamber music series in a bar that's become super, super successful. So I think, you know, especially the next generation is finding creative ways of bringing classical music into spaces that are sort of unconventional and finding a new audience, which is super important, I think.
I remember a conversation on my program some years ago with a member of some well-known trio that came to perform here in town at Carthage. And I remember learning then for the very first time the special joy that is part of playing in a piano trio, which is, of course, piano, violin, and cello. A different sort of joy versus what it's like to play in a string quartet. And at least the way it was described by this guest, that in a trio situation, the two string players are, in a sense, free to play more like soloists because you have that piano kind of serving as the anchor, and then the strings can kind of fly versus in a string quartet situation, at least most of the time, where there's something a little bit more mechanical about how it all kind of goes together and you really aren't operating as soloists in the same way. Does that make sense, that description of and does that reflect your experience being part of the Lincoln Trio?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I have probably quite a lot to say on that. Interestingly enough, so string quartet is, of course, the pinnacle of the chamber music repertoire, but that also is the most difficult as far as, you know, blending sound, and you really need to work together as a team in order to develop really a great string quartet sound. And that's why, as you know, as a string trio, as a string player, to sit down and play a string quartet is really wonderful. Now, to perform one, to come close to what a professional string quartet could do is almost impossible, because you have to live together, you have to, you know, develop your sound, and then you have your interpretation that you have to work together to make that happen. In a piano trio, we often say, you know, the piano drives the boat. and then, as you say, it's a much more soloistic, you know, view from the strings. So it's a completely different animal than a string quartet. And also in our case, David and I and the Lincoln Trio, we're married. We also have a string trio, which is again, a completely different soundscape, because as strings, the way you play with a violist and as a string trio is completely different than you play in the piano trio. So, you know, that's the beauty of chamber music. And then even more exciting sometimes is to add a wind player, you know, to do like the Brahms clarinet quintet, which is just such a glorious piece, and learning to breathe with a wind player and learning how they phrase and being able to hear a phrase played in such a long line and being a part of that. You know, we're just so lucky as string players to have this incredible chamber music repertoire. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with three guests previewing the concert coming up Saturday night by the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. We have with us Desiree Rustrat, who is the guest soloist, violinist, playing the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. With us as well is Maestro Robert Hasty, who will be on the podium conducting that, as well as the Overture to the Marriage of Figaro by Mozart and Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. And also with us is Pete Rodriguez, president of the Board of Directors and also a member of the horn section. So he will be on the stage as well for Saturday night's concert at the Ralph Houghton Auditorium at Reuther High School. Maestro Hasty, we should touch on the three works that are on the program. We probably don't need to say a whole lot about the Overture to the Marriage of Figaro, although that's not to dismiss it as a trifle. I mean, it's probably one of the most beautifully crafted of all opera overtures, and I should think probably serves really wonderfully as the opener to this concert.
Sure, I think that, and we can even make a little bit of a tie-in to the Eroica, which comes later, because in history shows that Napoleon Bonaparte was actually this work of Marriage of Figaro, written by Beaumarchais, was about giving a little bit more power to the people, and he was worried, he sniffed danger in the plot of this, and he called it the revolution already in action. And Mozart, after he wrote this this opera with Lorenzo de Pont, he just 2 days before the opening, he sketched out this overture. It's very, very short. It's a great way to open it. And the hijinks of the opera are in the overture. And it's just a hilarious way. It's comedy. It's a great way to start the opera. Now, speaking of Napoleon, who was really concerned about this play, about giving more power to the people, he is famously involved in and one of the inspirations for Beethoven writing his Third Symphony, which we now call the Eroica. So back in 1804, when it was first performed, there's this famous story of the fact that Beethoven, who was a fan of Napoleon at the time, he scratched out the words intitolate Bonaparte, and as soon as he as Napoleon declared himself emperor, Beethoven furiously took his eraser and erased that dedication on his score, and left a hole in the page. As a result, a couple of years later, he called it a Sinfonia Eroica, composed to celebrate the memory of a great man. So he completely changed it. One of the most important things that audiences should know is that this was one of the first symphonies that was written that had this length, about 45 to 50 minutes, depending on our tempo. And up until then, symphonies were rarely more than 30 minutes long. And it's a little bit more polyphonic. So in other words, there's more equality given to the bass line and more equality given to the alto lines, as opposed to a melody versus accompaniment. It demanded much greater virtuosity. It had some weird details in it, such as this famous misentrance of a horn player that he wrote in the first movement, which is a little bit of comedy that he's thrown in there as well. In the finale, he kind of goes back into what Franz Haydn did and wrote a theme of variations, which was also a little bit alarming. But not only does he do a theme and variations, he completely slows down the symphony at one point. He includes a funeral march in this symphony. He just has, and it was just kind of received. It had mixed reviews because of the fact that it required the listener to sit a little bit longer. But when we look back on it, it's arguably the greatest symphony ever written. And yes, I realize I'm putting that up there with the Ninth Symphony that Beethoven wrote himself, in terms of the way that it is written, the how it changed music history. It is one of the most important monuments in all of symphonic music.
For sure. I would really suggest people who want to know what you're talking about to sample the first and second symphonies of Beethoven, which at least to a large extent sure sound like Mozart or Haydn or whatever. I mean, maybe with a little hint of the flavor of Beethoven. And then you put on the third symphony, the Eroica, and it's like we're on a different planet in some ways. I mean, we've decisively stepped into something utterly new and amazing, and we get to hear this played Saturday night. And then, of course, right amongst the Mozart and the Beethoven then is this violin concerto by Tchaikovsky. We'll ask Desiree in a moment about her thoughts on this piece, but Maestro, tell us about folding this into the mix and what went into your thinking on that.
One of the most important things as a conductor, as a programmer, is that it has similar instrumentation. So being able to do this means that we don't have to bring in extra forces to come and play this. But for me, it's also a monumental, one of the most important works. But that's also in retrospect, kind of like the fact that Eroica wasn't as well received. When this was written by Tchaikovsky, he wrote it for a violinist named Leopold Auer, who pretty much rejected it and said it's not suited to the character of the violin. And so when it was eventually premiered by another violinist named Adolf Brodsky, He was applauded, but believe it or not, the audience hissed at the performance at the orchestra part, because probably because there were a lot of mistakes at the time. Now they've all been corrected in terms of the writing. They spent most of the rehearsals fixing errors, and they played it very, very softly. But now we consider it one of the most important, again, and this particular concert, if you were to put like the top five symphonies, the top five violin concertos, the top five overtures, we're doing one of the top five of each of these genres. But they all had really important historical, not just music history, but world history implications in all of these works.
Yeah, there's some, when it comes to repertoire, there's some heavy hitters on this program, that's for sure. All three works. Yeah. So, Desiree Rustrat, you're going to be playing the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto for us. First of all, tell us about your own personal history with this work. How has it figured in your own music making? And then we'll talk about the work itself.
Well, this is quite a wonderful story. It is a piece that, of course, as a kid, you always wanted to play. And I couldn't wait to play it for the first time. And I got it finally when I was 14 years old. My teacher gave it to me. And the first time I performed it actually was with the Colorado Symphony. Then, at the time, it was the Denver Symphony with Brian Priestman. And I was 16, so it was kind of my sweet 16 birthday present, and it was an extraordinary experience to sort of being able to play my dream concerto, and it was literally a few days before my 16th birthday. And a few weeks ago, the daughter of my violin teacher in Denver, who had passed over the summer, sent me music. And the first score I pulled out was the Tchaikovsky Concerto, just by happenstance. And I opened it up and it said Hans Whippler, which was his father. And it was dated from 1923. Oh. So I was holding in my hand a score that was 100 years old. So, and I had a student there at the time, and I said, look at this, isn't this just incredible? So it's always been a journey with that piece, but out of literally 13 boxes of music, I plunked this one score, and it was the Tchaikovsky. So it's a very special piece to me.
Mm-hmm. What is it like to play, and what particular challenges does it pose?
You know, it is just glorious to play. I'd say the biggest challenge is the length, and especially the length of the first movement. It has quite a lengthy first movement, but it is just full of just gorgeous themes and melodies. And, you know, it was like Tchaikovsky poured out his heart. He composed it at a time where I think he was incredibly depressed, and he had an ill-fated marriage at the time, and he also had a male lover, which was also, of course, at that time not very easy to navigate through. So, you know, it just, you can clearly hear the range of emotion from triumph to tragedy, and it's just quite an emotional piece, and very romantic moments, and for the orchestra as well, some of the greatest, most dramatic tutis in the orchestra that I think they always have fun to play. So, you know, it's just something that I think is a piece that everyone looks forward to playing and to hearing.
Very good. Maestro, what are the challenges of putting together a piece like this, for instance, compared to a Mozart concerto or something that's going to be just a touch more metronomic, a touch more stable in terms of what happens? This is, of course, a piece out of the Romantic period, and I'm guessing it poses a little more challenge in terms of really putting it together.
I think that this is true for accompanying any concerto. It requires the conductor, because typically, for instance, when I conduct the symphony or the overture, I really get to go with whatever the details that have been that I formulated in my head, and they come directly from my soul and from my heart, and I'm able to communicate through gesture and get response from the orchestra. But when anytime you are conducting a concerto, it's not just your heart and your soul. I'm trying to work very hard to figure out, and through a relationship with a soloist, I'm trying to figure out what it is that they want to express. So I'm now in the role of accompanist, and I have to defer everything to the soloist. And not only that, but my gesture, which is always in advance of the sound. So if you ever watch a conductor, I give a gesture and then the sound comes moments later. It's never simultaneous. So I have to know the soloist. I have to kind of anticipate what the soloist wants, because I also have to show in advance to the orchestra what it is that they are supposed to be doing in response. So that's one of the reasons why conducting a concerto is probably one of the most advanced levels of conducting. It helps to know the soloist as well. So as I mentioned earlier in this program, this will be, I believe, the third time that Desiree and I have collaborated. I know her playing much better than I would if this was a soloist that I have not worked with before. It's going to save a lot of time. It's going to help a lot for me to understand her playing. The fact that this concerto is also, for instance, whenever I hear orchestra auditions, this is probably, I hear this every third or fourth audition. I know this piece well. I'm a violinist, although I was never good enough to play this.
No, that's not true. I will tell you that was what I was going to add, Bob, is that also I think people don't, I don't know if your listeners know, but you are quite the accomplished violinist, and he is, I remember hearing you play, and I actually didn't know it was you, and I was walking by, and I said to my husband, I'm like, who's that violinist, you know, and it was you, Bob, so he is quite the accomplished violinist. Don't underestimate yourself.
Well, thank you so much. It certainly wasn't Tchaikovsky. I was literally playing in a blues rock and roll band.
No.
But anyway, Greg, just to answer your question, no, it's always a challenge, but it helps when you have somebody. Oh, the other thing about that's great about Desiree is that from working with her, there are some soloists who simply expect me to follow. And it's really almost like a one-way communication. But with Desiree, there's more of an interaction. And this is not just true with Desiree, but any of the most world's most important soloists, they understand that, oh, this is collaboration. This isn't, you know, soloist with accompanist, which they often have. So say, for instance, whenever I work with a young artist, somebody who's a teenager or a youth competition winner, they struggle. But with Desiree, it's like she and I are having a conversation and people are witnessing this conversation.
That sounds like the way it should be. So yes. The concert is coming up this Saturday evening, the 21st of October, 7:30 p.m. And we hope a lot of people are going to mark their calendars accordingly for this opportunity to experience three great, great masterworks in person. So Peter Rodriguez, for people who want to be part of this concert, who want to experience it, what can they do for tickets?
Yes, so we actually recently redesigned our website, so hopefully it'll be a lot easier to navigate. But if you go to KenoshaSymphony.org, you can purchase both season tickets as well as individual concert tickets. They are $30 to come to the concert on Saturday.
And are you looking forward to what you get to play on this concert, Peter?
Yes, actually, it's been a little bit for me since I've been able to perform with the Kenosha Symphony. I had some couple of surgeries last year, and I'm very excited to be able to be part of the group again. It'll be interesting because I play the French horn, and normally you hold the instrument with your left hand, but because of my surgery, I'm temporarily playing with my right hand. So I had my instrument modified so I can do that. So we'll see how that goes. But Bob has been very accommodating of my special needs at the moment. So see how that goes. It'll be
Very
interesting.
good. We wish you luck with that. And
Thank
it's
you.
been great to connect with you. And Desiree Rustrat, I know a lot of people are excited to see you and hear you in action with the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. And we wish you well with that. And of course, all your performances with the Lincoln Trio as well and everything else you're doing. And appreciate you being part of the morning show today.
Oh, thank you. And I'm so looking forward, and I'm looking forward to being with the orchestra and, of course, reconnecting with you, Bob. It's going to be really exciting to make music with you again.
Very good.
Report.
And Maestro Robert Hastie, make sure to bundle up for Wisconsin weather as you travel from your new home in Florida. And we wish you well with this concert and the remainder of this 84th season of the Kenosha Symphony.
Thank you so much, Greg.
I'm Greg
Thank you,
Winkler.
Greg.
You're welcome. And let's sample just a few moments from the beautiful concerto that will be played by Desiree Rustrat with the Kenosha Symphony this Saturday evening. Here is a little bit of the second movement of Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto. This is actually a recording on RCA Gold Seal featuring the great Yasha Heifetz with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. The great Yasha Heifetz with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, his Opus 35, Fritz Reiner, the conductor. This will be Desiree Rustrat with the Kenosha Symphony Saturday evening. And the concert will finish out with the monumental Symphony No. 3 in E-flat major, Opus 55 of Beethoven, known affectionately as the Eroica. And if you want ticket information about Saturday night's concert, you can go to the website of the Kenosha Symphony, which is kenoshasymphony.org. Here's a little bit of the first movement of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, which will be a stunning conclusion to Saturday night's concert. I'm Gregory Berg.